Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. This morning, the Food and Drug Administration released data that supports emergency use authorization for a coronavirus vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson. A panel of FDA advisors will meet Friday to make a final recommendation. Despite wide enthusiasm for vaccines, there is still substantial resistance to taking them, particularly among people of color, who are all too familiar with the well-documented history of abuse of the rights of people involved in medical research. My guest today is the award-winning author Harriet Washington. In her new book, she says that ethical violations in research are not a matter of distant history, but rather a current and serious problem. The book is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. We'll talk about it after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are along for the ride today. In the conversation about vaccine hesitancy among people in communities of color, people point to distrust of medical research that's premised on the experience in two famous cases. One is Henrietta Lacks, a black woman who died of cancer in the 1950s and whose extraordinary cells were harvested for research by doctors at Johns Hopkins without her consent. Those cells are still used for research today. The second is the case of the Tuskegee syphilis study, in which men who were infected with the disease were left untreated. The unethical and deadly behavior of researchers in the Tuskegee study was revealed in 1972. And for more than a decade, Johns Hopkins has honored the legacy of Henrietta Lacks and used her story to study its implications for informed consent in medicine. So does that mean that research, without the fully informed consent of participants, is a vestige of the past, and that current practice has what's necessary to safeguard against any future abuse? My guest today is the award-winning author Harriet Washington. She answers that question with a resounding no. In her latest book, Washington states flatly that, quote, "We have frequently abandoned informed consent, and today remain guilty of burgeoning medical experimentation without consent of any type." She goes on to say that informed consent, or even simple consent, have been withheld consistently in research with African Americans. The book is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. Harriet Washington joins us on Zoom. Miss Washington, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is a really important and, for me at least, incredibly revelatory and scary book in a lot of ways. And so I appreciate your having written it and your time talking about it today. Could we start, if you wouldn't mind, with a little primer about some of the terminology, and that is the different kinds of consent. You write about informed consent, simple consent, and presumed consent. Can you give us a little primer about what those three terms mean?
The important thing to remember is that semantics is sometimes used to deceive people. And many types of consent do not involve gaining the consent of the subject at all. For example, presumed consent. With presumed consent, the rationale is that one presumes that if asked, the subject would say yes, and therefore one doesn't ask. There's no possibility of giving or withholding one's consent. Consent is simply not part of the equation, but the terminology is used. And that's true of many of the labels that are constantly used in research, leading people to think that their consent is actually going to be elicited and sought after, and they'll have a chance to say yes or no, but in reality, they don't. So community consent is another one. It's not used as much now, thank goodness, but it's applied to situations where you're going to do research with no consent, and instead of getting people's consent, you go to the area where the people live and you have a meeting or two to tell them that you're going to do research with no consent. And it was initially called a community consent, even though, again, there's no chance to give or withhold one's consent. So semantics is a very powerful tool, and in this context, a very dangerous one.
In the case of Henrietta Lacks, for example, who was, as I mentioned, a patient at Johns Hopkins, I should say as well that Johns Hopkins is a sponsor of WYPR. Back in the 1950s, when she was hospitalized there for cancer, there were no established practices. I mean, I interviewed Rebecca Skloot about the book she wrote about Henrietta Lacks years ago when the book came out. And certainly the rules around informed consent were at the very nascent stages, if they existed at all. And I think that the folks at Hopkins would contend that what happened in the 1950s with Henrietta Lacks could never happen again today. But you don't necessarily think that that's the case.
I know that's not the case. I also know that the fiction is often verbalized that there was no informed consent in 1951 when Henrietta Lacks was a patient at Johns Hopkins. This fiction is often promulgated by writers who use it to say that there was no informed consent, the doctors could essentially do what they liked. I reviewed a book in the New York Times this summer where that sentiment was voiced by an author, but the truth is it's not true. There, we did not have the rich matrix of laws that we have today, but beginning in the 1950s, we had quite a few statutes that mandated informed consent for different reasons. We also had an AEC memo, a government memo that had been disseminated saying that in atomic energy programs, informed consent was required, and their consent required much more stringent terms than we use today. So informed consent certainly was known and certainly was used. It's not the case that there were no regulations. Unfortunately, the fiction that there were no regulations is sometimes used to normalize and excuse the abuse of African Americans who were treated very differently in medical contexts.
And you write that when it comes to this issue of vaccine hesitancy now around vaccines for COVID-19, that we should evaluate it in a more objective manner. And rather than say, why are people hesitant? Why won't they, you know, believe the science, et cetera, we should say, how can we meaningfully improve the trustworthiness of the U.S. healthcare system? So this has to do with more than just the vaccine, doesn't it?
Exactly. Very often when there are disparate treatment of African Americans, when they have a disparate profile in certain illnesses, there's an automatic assumption that a blame the victim narrative explains it. Well, African Americans aren't accepting the vaccine. African Americans won't participate in clinical research. African Americans are not observing social distancing. But those excuses and rationales are wrong. And part of the problem is that we interrogate and use strict scrutiny on African-American behavior when African-American behavior is only one component. The larger component is the untrustworthiness of the U.S. healthcare system. That's what needs to be interrogated. And very often when African-American behavior is offered as an excuse, it turns out not to be accurate. For example, last summer, every day we'd read newspaper headlines decrying the belief that African Americans were not participating in clinical trials. Yet, when I got the original data from a researcher at Johns Hopkins, it indicated that 10% of the subjects in Moderna trial and 10% in the Pfizer-BioNTech trial were African Americans. African Americans make up 12.3% of the U.S. population, which means they were very well represented. They represented about their levels of the population. They were not, there was no wholesale reluctance or a refusal to participate. And so now we're hearing the same narrative about African Americans supposedly rejecting the vaccine. But the truth is, we don't know that. We know they have less access to it, but we also have policies that restrict their access to it. And even if denialism were a factor, most vaccine denialists in this country are white. These are belief systems that transcend social strata and race. There are a great number of people who don't trust vaccines in this country. Most of them are white, so why the focus on African Americans?
Harriet Washington is my guest. She is the author of Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. To join our conversation with Ms. Washington, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. And to tweet me, it's @TomHallWYPR. This notion of consent has come up quite a bit around the coronavirus. You begin the book with the tale of a person named Robin Armstrong, who directs a nursing home in Texas. He's a Republican Party committee member, and he was giving hydroxychloroquine to patients in the nursing home without their consent. And not too long after he was prescribing this for people in the nursing home, the FDA revoked the authorization for the drug. So this is something that's happening now. This is not something that, you know, just happened back when Tuskegee was happening or something like that. This is a current thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's something happening consistently, but it's escalated since 1996. Before 1996, it was typically done illegally. There were laws mandating informed consent in research. But in 1996, exceptions were introduced. Trauma victims, a very wide group of people. You can now do research on trauma victims without getting their consent, as long as you adhere to certain conditions. And also there was a waiver of informed consent applied to, among other things, to drugs that are deemed to have only minimal risk. But these drugs are not drugs with minimal risk. Quite frequently, they're very dangerous drugs. They include ketamine. A lot of the people who receive ketamine injections end up in a ventilator on the hospital. So these exceptions have escalated, and we're seeing more and more. I counted tens of thousands of Americans who've been used in research without informed consent or any consent. And yet people seem not to know that this is an issue.
Yeah, I certainly didn't. And it's fascinating and infuriating on so many levels. You also talk about the existence of something that really floored me, which is non-consensual DNRs. A DNR is an order to do not resuscitate if a person in the hospital gets to the point where she requires a ventilator or some sort of, you know, imposition of therapy that would sustain and keep the person alive. How can there be something as fundamental as a DNR that is not directed by the patient?
This practice rose. I won't say it arose, but it rose during the coronavirus pandemic. You're right. It's supposed to be voluntary. And there are good reasons sometimes to restrict the care. Sometimes administering the care is more harmful and is not going to prolong the person's life or improve their health. So it can make sense, but you always need their permission. You always need to explain carefully and agree exactly what will and will not be done. You don't do it without getting people's permission. You don't do it without getting their consent. People who cannot give consent because they have cognitive issues, the family members or the appointed lawyers, there's someone appointed to give consent for them. But that fell by the wayside during the pandemic, and that's not unusual. Typically during urgent situations, like pandemics, for example, like wars, that's when we see a diminution in observing informed consent. That's when it tends to fall by the wayside. It's not observed. And urgency really fuels this. You know, the argument that we're in a situation where we don't have enough resources, don't have enough personnel, we don't have the luxury of time to explain things to people. It takes up too much time and effort that we don't have. And then it becomes much easier to dispense with it, either legally or illegally. But now that the law has been passed and one can do this legally in many cases, that really escalates a temptation to simply dispense with informed consent.
Harriet Washington is the author of Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. We'll have more with Harriet Washington after a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's at @MiddayWYPR. To tweet me, it's at @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. We'll talk about what he sees as the legislative progress and priorities of the council. So Nick Mosby will be my guest tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the author Harriet Washington. We're talking about her latest book, an examination of the rules and guidelines around medical research. It's called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, @MiddayWYPR. Ms. Washington, let's go to the phones, if you don't mind. Let's talk to Sue, who's calling from Parkville. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm really looking forward to reading your book, and I wanted to say how important this topic is. I am someone who has experienced being experimented on without my consent, and I'm all too aware that there are categories of patients who are at especially high risk for this, including disabled and ill patients, both because they're available and they're deemed to be defective. Iatrogenically injured patients because they're available and deemed to be potentially threatening, people with different sexual orientations that were once considered to be abnormal, which also kind of intersects with promiscuity, which was once considered to be, you know, something that made you a less desirable person, and that intersects with females in general getting treated badly, people with mental illness, people who are institutionalized, and soldiers. A lot of times soldiers are accused of malingering or that their shell shock is fake. And so this long history is so important that people understand. I really appreciate, you know, your focus on the African-American history. I think it's really important that people understand that this is very broad and it's getting much, much worse, as you explained.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Sue. And Harriet Washington, you do write about the military.
Exactly.
Bill Clinton signed a presidential executive order that allows the Department of Defense to experiment on service personnel without their consent or knowledge if it's deemed in the interest of national security. That's quite something.
Well, that was during a time when if you needed a waiver so that you didn't have to use informed consent, then you needed to get a presidential edict. There were a few other routes, but that was the major one. But researchers didn't want to have to go that route every time they experimented on people and didn't use informed consent without people's knowledge. That's why the 1996 law was passed and the 1996 waiver, so they could dispense with all that.
You write about a woman named Jamikia Barber. She is a private first class who refused to take shots for a vaccine against anthrax. Tell us about her story.
She was one of many. There were many service people who, when presented with the need to take experimental anthrax vaccines, no one asked their permission. They didn't have to because of Clinton's, edict. And also, so what happened was a lot of military people didn't want to take them. They were told that they were safe and FDA approved, but that wasn't quite true. They were FDA approved for cutaneous skin anthrax, but the inhalation anthrax is much deadlier, and that's what they were being threatened with, and that's what it was to affect. It never been tested for inhalation anthrax, so it was experimental, and they said, we don't want to take the risk. We're afraid that something might happen to us, and soldiers who would not take the anthrax were jailed, were court-martialed, court-martialed, thrown out of the army with less than honorable discharges, treated very badly. Some of these soldiers were also medical personnel. Doctors and nurses were in the number of soldiers who had been punished. The lucky ones, quote unquote, got off with a fine, but more usually they were jailed and or, you know, thrown out of the military. And Barbara was one of these. I think something Sue said was very important too. She pointed out that there are many groups of people who are vulnerable to this. And the book actually does not say this is only a problem of African Americans. The book says that all Americans are vulnerable to this. The same things that used to plague African Americans that I described in medical apartheid are now risk dangers for everybody in this country. So there are many groups. In fact, there's probably no group that's really going to be immune from it. The only reason why I think that some groups tend to be victimized more often, like people of color, is where the research studies are held. But because the numbers are burgeoning and we're seeing more and more of these, eventually they're going to be held in places other than places where the vulnerable people live. And all Americans are going to be at risk, which is why I thought it's so important that Americans at least know about this danger.
Yeah, so you talk about this correlation between where the major medical centers are, which are in urban areas, and their proximity because of where they're located to large communities often of African Americans. And it's that proximity that certainly makes it possible for abuses in the African American community to continue, right? In your mind, there's a direct link, huh?
Well, history tells us that proximity is intentional. That's no accident. In fact, when I researched medical apartheid, I found that, for example, you had medical schools deciding where they were going to locate, and cities and communities were vying for them. You know, build your school here. And one of the arguments that had been offered in one school that eventually was located in Richmond, Virginia, but was considering Philadelphia, was that you shouldn't go to Philadelphia because the people who do the labor in that city are white. You should come to Richmond, where black people do the work, and you have all these black laborers whose bodies you can use in your institution for training material and to display ailments. So there was a wide understanding that the bodies of African Americans and the bodies of very poor people were desirable, and schools would locate where they had, were near those bodies. So that was intentional. That was not an accident at all.
Yeah, Medical Apartheid, another one of your books. The latest book is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. The author is our guest, Harriet Washington. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. I want to ask you about a drug called polyheme, which was used tested, experimented on using ambulance drivers and people who were in obviously acute distress if they were in an ambulance being transported from wherever to the hospital. There's a woman that you whose story you tell named Martha Millette in Detroit. Tell us about her and this drug polyheme and how it was tested.
Certainly. Polyheme was actually a biological used as an artificial blood substitute. And the idea was that ambulances do not carry blood. They can't. It's too expensive. It takes up too much room. You need to be able to type and cross people. You need all kinds of blood types on the ambulance. You have to store it in the refrigerator. You have to rotate it. It's too expensive. So what we use instead is saline. Saline works perfectly fine for people who are, you know, most Americans who live in cities or suburbs are no more than 20 minutes from any hospital. So it works fine for them. Saline will keep you from going into shock and keep you alive and functional until you can get to the hospital. But they wanted artificial blood for people who live farther away. And who lives farther away? Typically, soldiers out in the field who may not get to a hospital for half a day, for example. And the artificial blood was touted as something that would keep them alive, but it was tested on civilians living in cities. So with Martha Millette, She had been, her home had been invaded by burglars who shot her in the chest. And the ambulance had picked her up. Before they took her and put her in the ambulance and cared for her, they stopped to open up a manila envelope with a computer printout that told them what to give her, whether to give her the standard of care, saline, or whether to give her the experimental polyheme. So they gave her the polyheme. She got to the hospital where blood was available, but she didn't get blood. They maintained giving her polyheme for 12 hours, not because that was known to improve her chance of survival or it was good for her, but because a study required it in order to analyze data. So the need of the study trumped her need to get the best proven treatment. She survived, fortunately, but she was one of 720 Americans who were enrolled in the polyheme study and never knew that they had been enrolled. She knew only because her daughter told her. The staff, she said, never told her she'd been in the experiment. And the people, you know, the way it was presented to people was very troubling. When a community was enrolled in a study, they told people in that community, listen, we've got this new cutting edge treatment. You're very lucky you live in this city, because if you are a trauma victim and you need blood, you know, you're going to get this cutting edge treatment. Well, that's not true. It was experimental. The safety and efficacy had not been proven. That's why it was being tested. And so a lot of the coverage that was puff coverage, very upbeat, it's, you know, would read like press releases. And when the data were finally analyzed, they discovered that people who had gotten polyheme, the artificial blood, had a higher rate of heart attacks and a higher rate of death. So it was actually worse than the standard of care. And people died in that study without ever knowing that they had been in a medical study.
You write about the semantics around these issues concerning medical consent, about how people who are participants in these studies, the subjects, are routinely called patients, which implies some sort of relationship, a doctor-patient relationship between the researcher and the person. But in fact, that's not what the relationship is in the research situation.
Yes, it can be confusing, because a doctor in his role as a physician treating a patient, is his efforts or her efforts are focused on maintaining the patient's wellness, her health, her dignity. Everything is focused on improving things for the patient. That's not true in research. There's a different aim there. Your focus is on the study, and your focus is on getting data that you need. And so the idea is to definitely benefit mankind. But with a research study, you're thinking about patients in the future. You're thinking about other people who might benefit. The subject is not your focus, and maintaining the subject's health is not your focus, and is frankly secondary. So to call subjects patients is very misleading.
But aren't researchers concerned about the health of their patients? I mean, I've interviewed people who were part of the Moderna and Pfizer trials for the vaccines against COVID-19, and they met with the research team regularly. They were paid for their visits to the clinics to have their blood pressure and vital signs taken, have blood drawn to monitor their progress, whether or not they received the placebo or the actual drug. And, you know, I think you can make a strong case that the researchers there, if they saw somebody was having any trouble, they were willing and ready to intervene.
You said it yourself. You called them patients. Don't they care about their patients? Of course they do. They care about their subjects too, but they treat them differently. Everything you described that they did for these subjects, monitoring their health, talking about the study, these things were done for the people at Tuskegee too. They also had regular testing. They also were given medication, not the medication they needed, of course. They, you know, so the truth is, if you look at their behavior, the researchers' behavior, it quickly becomes clear that the health of the subjects is secondary. And that's a definition of research. it's not that they're uncaring people, the researchers. That's not the point. The point is that the aim is different. So, of course, if something emerges during the study that augurs poorly for people's health, the researchers will make subjects know that. They have to by law. That's part of informed consent. But we're talking about studies that don't involve informed consent.
And let me go back to
not required to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we talked about informed consent and presumed consent. What's simple consent? How does that fit into the matrix?
Consent is simply getting, before there was a notion of informed consent, before that became law, before that became a rule, before, say, 1914, where the first ruling mandated it in the U.S., people only talked about eliciting consent. Simple yes or no. Researchers did not used to, in the 19th century and earlier, tell their potential subjects everything about the study as they do now. They didn't tell them what the known risks were, what the supposed benefits were, how it, you know, it might affect their life. You know, will they be too tired to drive? Will they be lose their appetite? All the things that informed consent mandates you tell subjects now. They didn't do all that, but they did have to say, are you willing to do this, yes or no? They did have to say, I would like to try X on you. Are you willing to do that? And that was observed very closely and consistently, except with African Americans. And of course, African Americans were not the only people who were barred from informed consent, but other groups in lower numbers. You know, if you were a poor immigrant, for example, you might also be treated in that manner. But African Americans were consistently barred from any informed consent. So simple consent, just getting yes or no. But even that is denied them. The laws that were passed in 1996, which by the way, anybody can look these laws up online and read for themselves what they say. Section 50.21.23 and 24, Code of Federal Regulations. And they stipulate that, you know, you don't have to inform the person that they're in the study. And you don't have to tell them anything about the study. You don't have to get their permission. So not getting their permission means that they don't even know it. They're in a research study.
Let's go to the phones before we take a quick break to Carol, who's calling from Severna Park. Carol, I understand that you're a nurse.
I am a nurse, yeah.
And what's your experience and your question for Ms. Washington?
I've worked in the pre-op area for pretty much most of my career, and my question is, where does your guest feel that it is most appropriate to consent a patient, in the doctor's office when they discuss the surgery or in the pre-op area? We kind of feel that patients in the pre-op area are too stressed, too apprehensive to sort of legitimately consent, but that's where a lot of consents are obtained, and I just wanted to know what your guest kind of felt about that.
All right, thanks for that question.
That's a good question, but I need to stipulate, when you read the book, you'll see that I focus on research settings. Informed consent in research is different from informed consent in clinical settings when you're a patient. That's not my focus. But I do know that informed consent in the clinical setting, I agree with you. It's ideal to do it outside of the setting when the patient is already about to undergo surgery, maybe under the influence of drugs that are necessary to prepare them, certainly is going to feel a lot of stress. It is much preferable to tell the person about all the known risks and benefits, everything they would need to know to make an informed decision about the surgery before they're in the clinical setting, before they're in the hospital bed, ideally in the doctor's office. With research, things are a little bit different because with research, the researcher himself has to do the responsible for the informed consent. But still, in those settings, it's a researcher who needs to specify all this information to the person before they even encounter the clinical setting, before they go into the hospital, before they're actually undergoing the treatment. That's ideal. I could not agree with you more. I have, and I think a lot of people have had, the experience of waking up at 6 o'clock, being woken at 6 o'clock in the morning before surgery and giving a sheaf of forms to sign. And if you've already begun receiving some of the anesthetic, you're not really in a condition to objectively. And frankly, if you had a question or objection, what are you going to do about it an hour or two before you're about to undergo surgery? If you need the surgery, there's little you can do. So I could not agree with you more.
Yeah, yeah, it is complicated. On the other hand, you know, it's premised in trust in your physician, you know, the trust you have in the surgeon and the trust you have in the institution where you are being treated. The book is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. The author is my guest, Harriet Washington. We'll have more on this very complicated and fascinating topic when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to tweet us. It's @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Harriet Washington. She lectures on bioethics at Columbia University. She won the National Book Critics Circle Award and other honors for her book, Medical Apartheid. She's been a research fellow at Harvard Medical School, a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University, and a John S. Knight Fellow at Stanford University. She's written 4 books, and we're talking about the latest one, which is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Ms. Washington, I want to talk about a study that was conducted here in Baltimore in 2010, which involved inducing hypothermia for people who had been wounded, usually in shootings, I guess. Talk about what happened in that study and the position of the people who were being treated at that point.
That study is a very troubling one. Anyone who's familiar with hypothermia, a lot of us are, know that it's part of what's called the triad of death. It's a very dangerous condition. When the human body's core temperature drops below, say, a certain number of degrees, it's disastrous. Your body shuts down, cardiac system shuts down, death ensues. It's so dangerous that even rewarming the person and trying to get their core temperature up to normal, that's when a lot of heart attacks occur. So it's very dangerous. And when I worked in the emergency department, I saw it frequently, you know, ATV accidents, automobile accidents in frigid weather. Many things will boost chance of a hypothermia. But doctors at Shock Trauma in Baltimore want to induce hypothermia. Now, they say they want to induce it because they look at a few people, typically children, who have survived drowning, for example, and the theory is that because the water was so cold and the kids suffered hypothermia, that cold state helped them to survive and be resuscitated after people thought they would have been dead. So based on that, which quite frankly sounds to me like a very flimsy rationale, they've decided they're going to start inducing hypothermia in gunshot victims. I read a New York article about this, and I was really concerned because it said specifically they were focusing on African-American gunshot victims. My goodness, why African-Americans? First of all, if being a gunshot victim, okay, if they were African-Americans, the article also said because they have a high rate of gunshot, of death by gunshot wounds. They didn't say they had the highest rate. They said they have a high rate. But the truth is Americans have a high rate. We have a high rate of gun deaths, high rates of gunshot wounds. And in the year I read that, in 2016, 9,000 white men in this country suffered gunshot wounds. 6,000 black men suffered them. So if having a gunshot wound were indeed a rationale for being subject to hypothermia, then it would be white men rather than black men who would be subject to it. But the truth is, it's not a good rationale for anyone. And I was concerned that black men were being singled out and an empathy-damping rationale of there being gunshot wound victims that taps into a trope about African-American men being violent. The truth is, if you look at heart problems, African-American men have higher rates of death from heart attacks and a variety of cardiac illnesses. So why single out gunshot wounds? And why indeed induce hypothermia? If there were data showing us that people indeed survived more, that would be one thing. But they offered no such data. The original article offered no such data. And they claimed they would publish data in 2 years. But it's now been 5 years, and there's been nothing. I spoke to the press officer at the university about the trial, and she told me that nothing has yet been published. And yet they're conducting this trial. They wouldn't speak with me. I tried to talk to the PI, principal investigator, many, many times. Email, telephone, through the press office, everything. And he wouldn't speak to me. But he did speak to New Scientist magazine, for which I write sometimes. And New Scientist wrote an article calling it suspended animation, which is misleading terminology. It gives the impression that it's somehow controllable and reversible, which hypothermia is not. Reversible consistently. There's no promise you'll be able to reverse this condition if you induce it. And there's no evidence anybody has survived. The other thing I read regarding the protocol for the study concerned me deeply. We were talking about researchers' motivations. You know, don't researchers care about their subjects? Don't they care about preserving their lives? I think it's good to talk about their motivations because the thing, we don't do that. We always assume that researchers are altruistic and also that they're objective, that you know they're looking for scientific data, that they're not biased. But the principal investigator, the protocol said very clearly that he has a financial stake in this. If it's successful, he will make money. It doesn't say how much money, but he's got a patent on the devices they use in this. And that's a conflict of interest. That's certainly something that's verboten. Ethically, it's completely not unacceptable to have such a blatant financial conflict of interest. And conflicts of interest don't have to be financial. They could also be in terms of academic advancement. There are many ways in which researchers benefit from research. And it's not that it's a bad thing for them to benefit, but benefiting financially has been demonstrated to have an effect on the outcome. The reporting of studies find that the reports tend to favor the source of income. So an influx of cash to a researcher is likely to introduce bias into the study. It's that simple. So it's a very troubling study on almost every ethical level I can think of. Sorry is being conducted.
Yeah, let me ask you about one of the levels, because it you bring up a number of really, really compelling points. But when it comes to the racial mix of the people in the study, while it's true nationally, and I trust your numbers in terms of the number of white people who are shot, etc. Here in Baltimore, where shock trauma is located, the vast majority of gunshot victims are African Americans. I mean, that's been the case in our city, regrettably, for a long time. So if they're the patients who are in the, and there I am using the word patients again, but if they are the subjects that are there in the hospital in life-threatening situations, they, of course, are the ones that are going to be involved if people agree that this is a legitimate thing to pursue. Now, whether or not it's legitimate, you make a good point about that. Yeah.
But if I may, I want to address that because it's very commonly used rationale and it's wrong. Let me explain to you why it's wrong. Baltimore is primarily African-American city. So it's not to say that most of the gunshot wound victims there are African-American tells us nothing. If you look at the rate national, it doesn't reflect that. But let's say we're only looking at Baltimore. It violates something called distributive justice. That's when you have one group that absorb the risk of research. Medical research, even when it's conducted completely ethically and a really logically and carefully designed study, it's still risky. It's the nature of it. That's what we call it, research. If we were talking about an approved treatment, then your rationale would make sense. Something that we knew would help people and that we knew would not endanger them more than it helped them. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about something that's unproven, whose risks we know, whose benefits we don't know, have not been demonstrated. And so you have to look at justice in terms of having one group accept the risk. Don't forget that once the whole point of the research is that once it's published and once we find something out, it's going to apply to medicine for all people. So suppose we conduct a study, and it's very likely, quite frankly, and find that, like polyheme, hypothermia only introduces risk and no benefits. People don't fare well. People don't survive. There are no or very few observable benefits. Now you've subjected African Americans to this risk and not whites. But let's say we find it benefits people. Even then, what we end up with are African Americans who've been subjected to risks and then benefits that apply to everybody. That's unfair. Distributive justice is really important. You don't want to, if you want to be fair and ethical, you cannot subject one group to the risk disproportionately and have other groups enjoy the benefits. And that's exactly what would happen, even in the best case scenario in this research.
This is such a great conversation. We have a few minutes left, and I want to go to the phones to Vera, who is calling from Parkville. Welcome to Midday with Harriet Washington.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity, and I wanted to thank Ms. Washington for her research. I haven't read her book yet, but I intend to. And one of the things that I don't know, she just touched on it a moment ago, which I think has to do with the socioeconomic sort of effect on people of color, that they participate in some of this research studies because they need money. And in fact, I participated in a research study some years ago. It wasn't a drug study. It was just questions, and it took a period of time. But the draw for me was actually the $50 that they paid cash, you know, for my time, I guess. And
sure.
So I participated.
That's a really important point.
If you could just talk a little bit about that, if that's what puts us more at risk in some
yes,
cases.
Yes, I think that's a really good important point. I'd love
excellent
to address
question.
It.
Excellent question. Yeah, please.
Paying people for research study is something that I disagree with. And there's a disconnect here. It's a cultural problem, in part at least. What I saw when I was at Harvard Medical School studying medical ethics in clinical settings was that my professors would say to me, oh, you know, we give people $50, a couple hundred dollars. It's just a token of goodwill. And I say, you're a highly paid professor at Harvard Medical School. For you, it's a token of goodwill. To that woman, it's feeding her children this week. So you have to understand that in some groups, some income groups, and frankly, I think for most income groups in this country, there's undue inducement. I won't say it's coercive necessarily. Person still has the right, you know, ability to say no, but it's hard to say no to a couple hundred dollars if you're living, you know, hand to mouth. And the inducement is simply not acceptable. It's not acceptable at all. And we need to find better ways of rewarding people for engaging in clinical research that don't involve giving them money.
Harriet Washington, her latest book is called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. We are out of time now, but I want to let listeners know that at the end of the book, Ms. Washington has a very extensive section about her suggestions as to how things can be fixed, how things can be organized and regulated to solve some of these problems that she so compellingly brings up. Harriet Washington, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate it.
I enjoyed it too. Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, I'll have a conversation with Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. I hope you can join us then. Coming up now, after the news at the top of the hour, it's Future City with Wes Moore. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. And that later you'll download The Daily Dose. That's WIPR's compendium of local news with Aaron Henkin. As well, we hope you'll check out the Chesapeake Connect podcast. That's a podcast about regionalism in the Baltimore metro area. I host that podcast. There's some interesting conversations there, and I urge you to check them out on the WIPR website, the Chesapeake Connect podcast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.